which might have appeared during this session. You can write it down in Kaplan or whatever, and prepare for tomorrow. Remember that tomorrow from 12 to 2 o'clock, we are going to have just a question session.
Thank you. I keep my promises. You remember when you talk about the world in the morning and talk about soul and body in the afternoon. One of the questions remained unanswered because we ran out of time. You remember also that when I mentioned or discussed the matter, the subject matter, our soul and body, I said that there are four different kinds of approaches to the soul and the problem. The first was that the soul is imprisoned in the body. The second was that the body is imprisoned in the soul. The third was that the soul is the expression, the body expresses the soul. That was a philosophic position. And the fourth category was chain of body soul occurrences. The body and soul are always acting in concert. Neither can act without the other and vice versa. And this fourth category would have been the discussion of feelings and emotions. So I tried to say something about them when discussing shame, this happened yesterday. But I promise that today, since I have a problem which which we are going to discuss today, is the role of emotions in the receptions of our work, and I will tell you something more about emotions. Someone asked me the question, what about sentiments? I don't know who was it. What about sentiments? Why don't they speak about sentiments? Yeah, so I will mention here sentiments as well. So when we speak about the role of emotions in the reception of artwork, we have to address first the question, what emotions are. When we talk about emotions, we need to start with feelings, with so-called simple feelings. Simple feelings, which can also be called pure feelings, they are pure because the situation and cognition is not in the yet in the feeling itself. They are the elements, they are the feeling stones of all kinds of emotions and emotional dispositions, sentiments. Simple feelings, among the simple feelings, I mentioned the affects when we discussed shame, and I thought that all the affects are innate, that they are expressive, that the satisfaction of one can replace the satisfaction of the other, that they are contagious, and that they are also transformed into emotions whenever they react, they reflect upon concrete situations, and that cognition is imbued in the emotions. So you remember I said that to be afraid from the world is different from being afraid of feeling an examination. That's again a feeling which is different from the feeling of fear about losing a beloved person, which is again different from the feeling of fear to be found out. That is cognition. And situation is in the feeling, the fear which you feel when you are confronted with the world, the fear that you are feel when you are confronted with the possible death of a beloved person, the feeling of fear when you are afraid of being found out, are different feelings, and the feeling quality is different, although you call all of them fear, because all of them is fear, even though they are not implications of the effect of fear, of the originally simple effect of fear. This is what I said about the effects, because shame is one effect among the others, which is also innate, not in the higher races of animals or species of animals, but innate only in human persons. But I have to mention, although it was visible, there are other simple feelings as well, not just affects. And we can presuppose the other simple feelings are also in name. The most general feelings, all philosophers refer to, are the positive or negative feelings. That is the feeling good or bad. That is the element of feeling something is good, something is bad. I feel that it is bad, I feel that it is good. I would say that newborn infants have no other feelings but this. Because there is no differentiation of feelings, of disgust, of fear, of feeling uncomfortable. No, there is only a feeling of yes and feeling of no, the feeling something wrong and feeling something is okay. And these are the most elementary feelings. Philosophers who wrote books about feelings, or at least parts of the books about feeling, like, for example, Hume in his Theories, normally speak about pain and pleasure. And the pain and pleasure are the elementary feelings, basically the building blocks of all kinds of emotions. Because all kinds of emotions and sentiments are perhaps either positive or negative, they are either painful or pleasurable, and this is why these simple feelings are regarded as the building blocks of all emotions and all sentiments. I also mentioned joy and sadness among the affects. Joy and sadness are also building blocks of all positive emotions and sentiments, although they are not exactly the same as pain and pleasure. Because pain and pleasure includes the kind of feelings which are so initiated by the body. Whereas when you speak about joy and sadness, they are not initiated by the body, but they are initiated by the psyche, they are initiated by the soul, although they are also manifest as effects in the body, as they are expressing, you express them in the body. But these are basically the simple elemental feelings, which are the building blocks of all possible emotions and feelings, and also the emotional feelings in the reception of the other. In the reception of the other, however, not all simple feelings can take part. Among the simple feelings, only the feelings of joy and sorrow, and the elementary feelings of joy and sorrow, and the elementary feelings of pain and pleasure participate in the reception of the verbal part. And pain or pleasure are only in a very subjugated manner, they cannot be initiated by the body, and they also must be initiated by the soul. That is, the simple feelings which become transformed to emotions and transformed to sentiments, they are very much limited to a few simple feelings and not to others. Now, I haven't distinguished yet between emotions and emotional dispositions. Emotional dispositions are also called sometimes sentiments. Emotions are emotional occurrences. You feel them in a moment and they are gone. And they are always the same quality, the same quality. Feeling of fear can be different when you feel from the world that are afraid of losing someone you love, but the feeling of fear, it grasps you and you feel only one emotion. You feel the emotion of fear. That we call emotion occurrence, because it occurs. It does not need to be momentary, but it is, if it lasts in the same or similar quality. If you are afraid of the world, that lasts only for a few minutes, because the world is here or disappears or does some harm. But it is a momentary feeling. It's a kind of a shock feeling. If you are afraid of losing someone, this lasts in time, but the quality of the feeling is either exactly the same or it is transforming into something similar. But this is why it is an emotional occurrence. The emotional disposition is, however, an emotion, that's why it's called also sentiment, which is lasting, and not just lasting, but goes together with entirely different emotional occurrences. This is, for example, when I speak about emotional disposition, I speak normally first about love and hate. By the way, all philosophers who were interested in emotions spoke first about love and hate as typical emotional dispositions. Why is that? Why are they not emotional occurrences, but emotional dispositions? Because if I love someone, the feeling of love can be of the same quality. But feeling of love, which lasts in time, which expands in time, can include entirely different field occurrences. If I love someone and the person is sick, I feel grief. If I love someone and the person gets another, I feel pleasure. If I love someone, but the other loves someone else, then I feel jealousy. So I can have entirely different kind of feelings of the positive and also of the negative kind. They can be pains and they can be pleasures as well. They could be good feeling and bad feeling, and entirely different kind of emotional occurrences appear. If we do have an emotional disposition. Disposition, the word you know very from right from physics. For example, this piece of paper has a disposition to burn, which does not mean that every piece of paper burns. This piece of paper hopefully will not be burned, but who knows? But has a disposition, if it needs certain kind of fire, then it's going to be burned. That's the disposition. The same is with emotional dispositions. Emotional disposition, if I love someone, this disposition is possible that I feel grief, or I feel jealousy, or I feel pleasure, or I feel happiness, or whatever. But I do not necessarily have these feelings. If a person I love will never be sick and his well-being is always secure, then I will never feel sadness or anxiety. That is, the disposition is there, but this paper will not be burned. But the disposition is there, under certain circumstances, in certain situations, in life. When I interpret the situation this and that, I can feel entirely different kind of feelings. So that's why I mentioned jealousy. The jealousy is typical emotional disposition, which may occur. It's very frequently occurs that it burns. In the case of love, especially in the case of being in love, and also in the relationship of friendship, in the relationship of friendly feelings and sentiments. Sometimes even other complex emotions are called emotional dispositions, and emotional dispositions other times are basically character traits. Certain kind of character have a disposition towards jealousy, have a disposition towards envy, have a disposition towards hatred, and basically the character is already described as a kind of emotional disposition, and we characterize this person with that, in a term, you know what, he is a jealous man, and he's a jealous man, he is a miser, that we know that there is an emotional disposition which makes this person very likely to develop this and that kind of emotional occurrences, to appear this and this and that situations. So now I think it is understandable. What is the difference between simple feelings and emotions? What is the difference between emotional occurrences and emotional dispositions? And what is the difference between simple feelings as affects, shame, disgust, etc., and other simple feelings which are normally identified as yes feeling or no feeling, positive feeling and negative feeling? These yes feeling and no feeling are not necessarily also complex emotions. They can remain cognitive feelings as well. Cognitive feelings that if you have a mathematical equation to solve, this is not I have the feeling that this would be the right thing to do. You see that there is a yes feeling which accompanies one type of solution, and no feeling which accompanies other type of solution. Sometimes you see it's an instinct. You should do this, you should do that. You have what is always a kind of feeling. Because if I want to give a definition of feelings in general, whether simple feelings affect emotions or emotional dispositions or sentiments, I would say that feeling means to be involved in something. It's very broadly, feeling is an involvement. And would even add, there is no cognition without feeling. You cannot see without feeling. That is the distinction, the strong philosophical distinction of psychology of the 19th century between thinking and feeling is a bad distinction, because first and foremost we cannot think without feeling because we have no involvement in anything, and on the other hand, Every feeling is a judgment, but feelings are judgment. When you feel something, you judge that situation. You make a judgment, and for emotions especially, you always make a judgment about a situation. If you are jealous, you make a judgment about something. You see you belong to kiss someone on the street corner. You make a judgment, you are jealous. But the judgment can be a wrong judgment, because feelings, in this respect, are cognitive, they make judgment, and since and every judgment can be true or false. You see, you remember Figaro's wedding, when Figaro sees his mother, when Susan sees Figaro kissing his mother, you remember, Susan enters, and she sees that Figaro, her beloved, kisses the mother. She misinterprets the situation, and she's terribly jealous, because she believes that Figaro has agreed to marry Marcelina. That this is a marriage kiss. So she's terribly afraid. And Figaro is, cool down, she is my mother. And of course, in the moment, jealous is a feeling disappears, because feelings are judgments. Judgment, or even the simple feelings are judgment, and if the situation changes, if they realize that the situation is misinterpreted, then the feeling disappears, because the judgment disappears. So all feelings are judgments. Now, let's make us get much help to be said about feelings, emotions, and sentiments before I come to the problem of the present day, namely about the problem of the role of emotions in the perceptions of words of God. I have to introduce this topic with returning to the problem of emotions and feelings in traditional metaphysical philosophies. It was mentioned many times, and I repeat only now, that emotions and feelings occupy a very low place in metaphysical thinking. Because it was the similar emotion which combined in metaphysical thinking the two aspects of the metaphysical philosophy, namely the theoretical speculative aspect and the practical moral aspect. Now, every metaphysical philosophy needs to build a system, and the system must click, must be put together in a so-called coherent way, not contradictory way. And this is why the epistemological, ontological, and the moral aspect, the theoretical, practical, have to be fitted through. Now, in the epistemological aspect of metaphysical philosophy, sensual experience, that is, experience of the senses, sensual, about the experience with our eyes, or with our hands, or with our ear, or whatever is sensual, is basically considered to be contingent, is considered to be ephemera, is considered to be subjective, and this is why considered to be untrue. You have to abandon this level of sensual experience, that is called sometimes mere empirical, and you have to be lifted up to the kind of epistemological territory which is represented with pure cognition, understanding, and reason in later philosophy. In earlier philosophy, it was logos, episteme, and nous, and that are different aspects of understanding through our reason. That is reason which is entirely void of any kind of sensual experience, can grasp the truth, can grasp the eternal, can grasp the absolute, and can grasp something which is objective. That is, the less sensual experience, the more reason, rationality, grasping by reason, the more objective your knowledge, and the more universal your knowledge, the more necessarily your knowledge becomes. Then you achieve something which is truth. You must leave these sensual experiences behind you. This is epistemology. Now, ethically, you need to go through the same kind of way of thinking in order to make the system clear. Now, in the case of moral behavior, in practical and pragmatic behavior, it's emotions who play the role of sensual experience. That it is feelings and emotions, they are subjective, they are different, they are contingent. And from these emotions of everyday encounters, we have to climb up also in moral philosophy to the new cognitive level, that is, reason has to guide our action. That is, our moral thing has to be also guided by reason. Not only our knowledge, epistemological aspect has to be guided by reason alone, but our practical behavior needs to be also controlled by reason. That is, emotions, mere feelings, simple feelings, that is, that our involvement in the things which we are doing are treated on the same level as sensual knowledge. That knowledge we get through all the senses. That we know that we are here because I see you are here, is treated exactly the same way that I feel myself at the moment involved in what I am telling you. Because both are subjective, both are related to your feeling, person, very personal, and both are certainly ephemeral and contingent and transient. And so, we go and pass up, and reason collects. Reason or intellect, whatever philosophy are confronted with, they are the ones which collect all this kind of higher knowledge or higher kind of attitude in one. So this is the metaphysical system. Well, metaphysical system, metaphysical thinkers also discuss the problems of feelings and emotions, but in different ways. Aristotle, for example, discussed it in three times, but now I mentioned only the two, the third class data. He speaks about emotions and feelings in his ethics, and he speaks about that in rhetorics. And the approaches are very different, because in his ethics, he takes the moral epistemological position. That is, emotions are going to be located in the so-called allogon, in the non-logical part of the mind, of the psyche. They are considered to be chaotic, and they are considered to be not rational. Whereas, of course, the reason which is in the rational part of the soul can grasp them and form this matter into virtues. That is, they also they are treated as role and reality, which are formed by our mind into virtues. But in rhetorics, basically, Aristotle treats feelings and emotions on their own right. And when I start telling you something about the difference between simple feelings and emotions, and that cognition is inbuilt in emotions themselves, this is treated in the same way by Aristotle in rhetorics. Because in rhetorics, Aristotle has to deal with persuasion, not with dialectics. And the question, how can people be persuaded? People can be killed and persuaded only many times, it says, that their feelings need to be mobilized, that people should be persuaded. So he has to find out how you can mobilize emotions, feelings, in order to persuade people to do what I want them to do, or to appreciate what I want them to appreciate. So then he really treats emotions and feelings in a very modern way, if I may say so. That normally in the metaphysical tradition, emotions were discussed in certain kind of contempt because they were regarded as the lower level or even in the psyche, but even more in the human cognitive capacity as such. There was an interesting, I will call you mention one. Author whose theory of emotions might have some interest for you, and it is Descartes, Passions of the Soul, because he made a very interesting remark that there are no evil passions, that all passions are basically good. And there is only one evil thing in man, and this is fanaticism. That is, evil comes from the brain and not from the passions. It is a very interesting and very new kind of approach. He hasn't elaborated it. But I think you can learn a lot about Descartes' Passions of the Soul from this respect. But now I leave the general theory of passions behind and we'll talk only about the role of emotions in the receptions of the world. And immediately look at something which is very funny. In the older metaphysical thinkers who were keen to express this contempt for emotions and at least treat them as mere material, chaotic and poor, had an entirely different position when it came to the inception of Berkhofer. Somehow, when it came to the inception of Berkhofer, sometimes in the creation of the Berkhofer, they started to speak about feelings and emotions in a very positive way. Even Plato, when he speaks about poetic madness, which is one of the four great madnesses, poetic madness is a great thing. And if you are carried away with poetic madness, then you can fly up. You fly up on the ladder, epistemological ladder, which carries you away. So Ticino even said that Plato himself was possessed by poetic madness, that philosophy itself is nothing else but the manifestation of poetic madness. But in the case of reception, that is always the case. For example, in Aristotle, when in an alternative of the poetics, when he speaks about reception, and he speaks about the reception of the tragedy, then he makes the point that the feelings the tragedy elicits in the recipient purifies the soul of the recipient. It has the course of purification. It purifies that the two feelings which are the effects of tragedy, one of it is empathy, the other is anxiety, that these two feelings, empathy and anxiety, purify your soul from the merely ego-related feelings. Because these feelings are related to the fate of another person, to the fate of a suffering tragic hero. And you are, by identification with this suffering tragic hero, you purify your own soul from what? From the ego-centered feelings, from the ego-related anxiety. You get rid of it. So it has a purifying effect. In fact, in certain cases, not necessarily tragedy, but it is the music, for example, that music, the reception of music, has a healing effect, has a curing effect. It's basically as old as human culture, known by us itself. Orpheus, the story of Orpheus, or the story of King David as a young man, playing for soul. That's how music can cure a soul. How can music transform the simple man into a good person? How can it make the stone heart to mend and become good? And this effect of music is discussed in poetry. And philosophers took it over. Somehow, the exception of the work of art made an exception. It was the exception of beauty, was also making an exception. And Plato says, if you love beauty, you love truth. Truth and the beautiful are identified. The love of the beautiful is in itself the love of truth. So if you are filled with the love for beauty, that is the attitude of the recipient, then you are also filled with the love of truth or goodness. So goodness, truth, and beauty are somehow connected with each other, and that is the aesthetic recipient, if I may say so. Aesthetic recipient is a company with a feeling which is different from all other kinds of feeling. A feeling which is very highly appreciated also in the traditional metaphysical conception. Now let me now speak about our problem and whether we can rely upon the old sages in the understanding or the section of work of art, and whether they had a point. And so whether they had a point in which we can accept about the feelings created in the section of works of art, whether they had a point. First, I want to speak about it in general terms, then I want to talk about the reception of different kinds of arts. I said very in advance that I think that work of art is a great generalization, and it is a modern generalization. The art was invented in the time when all the universals were invented, that is roughly at the time of Enlightenment, He was under the light and who spoke about painting and sculpture and music and literature and poetry, and we have formed this universal concept of art. But since it is formed, I start with that, and later on I'm going to talk about different branches of art only from the standpoint of the progressive name. Now, of course, this is a limitation. Because from the 19th century onwards, not earlier, philosophers, post-metaphysical philosophers, started to talk also about the role of emotions in the creation of the profile. Not just in the case of reception, but also in the creation of works of art. First, they spoke about the reception, that was also the case by Renaissance thinking by Leonardo da Vinci, but speaking about philosophy in strict sense, it was the case by Hutcheson, by Shaftesbury, and by Hume, and by Immanuel Kant already, but they spoke always about the emotions of the recipient, not the emotions of the creators. The emotions of the creator start to be a role since Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, in Nietzsche a very great role, that what kind of emotional input you need to create a work of art. And I will neglect this problem. First of all, because it's very complex. Second, because the role of emotions in creation of work of art is far more related to the difference of single artists. It is different in the case of single artists, so I think it must be rather specified. I want to abandon this topic, and what happens now, I'm going to speak only about the role of emotions in the case of the recipient of artwork. First, generally about artworks, and then separately about different types of artworks, because in my mind they are different in time, in art. What happens? In everyday life, you are a person with a certain kind of involvement in your daily life. Feeling means to be involved in something. You are involved in pragmatic and practical life. You have an involvement which is always also ego involvement, because your ego is always involved in every kind of everyday activity. So there is an ego-centered aspect of everyday emotions and feelings. Let me return to the example of what I think it was already Aristotle's example about jealousy. You see a person kissing your beloved, you are jealous. You find it out that it is that he kissed his mother, then jealousy disappears. This means that the emotion inside is ego-centered. In my, the very view of myself depends on the interpretation and the judgment which is done by my emotion. But the interpretation includes my ego-relatedness. That's an ego-relatedness in every everyday emotion and feeling. It orients us in everyday life. It makes judgment what is good for us, what is bad for us. This is ego-related. And all emotions in everyday life, the emotional dispositions are included, are ego-related, which does not mean that they are egoistic, because altruistic feelings are all ego-related. Now, altruistic feelings are connected to a big consciousness and not an I consciousness, they are also ego-related. Now, what happens if you are confronted with the work of art? That is, you turn towards the work of art. You turn towards the work of art, you are readiness for deception. Now, readiness for deception, you become entirely ear or entirely eye, concentrating, you suspend your everyday experiences. You cannot work out this readiness for deception, for the work of art, without suspending your everyday concerns and everyday activities. Otherwise, there is no reception of this work of art. If you continue to in the kitchen with your work and there is a radio in the background sounding, it is not reception of this work of art, which is on the radio, there is background music. When you do a background, you can do more many other things, but there is still a background music. in the reception of the profound spirit, only about the pure reception of the profound, he turned towards the very profound, then he suspend your everyday activities. And by suspending everyday activities, you already suspend your everyday feelings and everyday emotions. Which does not mean that you remain without feelings, but it means that the everyday emotions, emotional dispositions included, which are complex combinations of situation, cognition, and some simple emotions, are basically dissolving. They are dissolved in simple emotions, simple feelings. And then what happens if you are in the state of readiness for receiving a work of art, that you comprehend every emotions, your envies, your jealousies, you love your neighbor, your love of food, your hatred against your enemies, everything disappears in this moment, and they are suspended. They are only suspended, they will be reconstructed the moment you turn away from the work of art, they will be reconstructed, but they are suspended for the time being because you are in work, you have a readiness for the reception of this work of art. But that is the emotions are, you know, mostly all emotions, with some exception I turn to them later, are dissolved into very simple feeling. That you look at the work of art and all your emotional life is becomes emotional life of simple feeling. Because it is through and in the reception of the work of art, in the reception of what you see and what you hear, that these feelings will be reorganized into emotions. But they will be organized into different kinds of emotions, the kind of emotions which are triggered by hearing or viewing or reading this work of art. That the work of art will itself trigger certain impacts, and some certain impacts on you which make your simple feelings be reorganized again into emotions. The main emotion is, the leading emotion is always the love to the work of art. Because there is no reception without love for the work of art. There is a love for the work of art, the readiness is transformed into love for this work of art. And this love of the work of art must be mutual. That is, the work of art is to love you because it can come to a reception only if love is mutual. In fact, every love is mutual, you know that. That is not mutual, can hardly call love. That is, there is a kind of mutual love. And just as in a love life, if you see the, or hear the same work of art for second and third time, your love can be intensified, but you can also come to disappointment. You can be also disappointed. You can say, the first love was wrong. I judge it differently. I love the work of art because it's not really good, it's not really beautiful. Okay, I turn away from it. But the same thing can happen with the work of art, what happens with your love life. It is harder on temperature. And this is very important. That's why philosophers were keen to make an exception about feelings which occur by the reception of the work of art. All feelings and all reorganized emotions are contemplative. This is totally different attitude. Because the attitude of the daily life is suspended. The attitude towards work of art is contemplative. You just look or just hear, you don't touch. And this, if you look at the beautiful woman, I don't see the man feel a carnal desire for this woman, because this is a practical attitude, it's not a contemplative attitude. That is, you always will have a contemplative attitude to words of art, but contemplative doesn't mean passive, because we are in love, and we desire to be loved by the work of art. But we do not touch it. We do not touch it, we look at it, we hear it, and this basically, that's all already boosting toward you there, that only two senses are activated in the reception of the work of art, the eye and the ear. No other sense can be activated. And in fact, St. Augustine gave an answer to the question 5. He said they are theoretical emotions.
see what I think your sense is. You have seen what I think your sense is. See what I think your sense is. Can be beautiful in that sense. This is why nobody, you don't have an art for piercing or art for smelling. An art has to be together with seeing or hearing or feeling, because they are universal senses. You can have universal feelings by motivating these senses. So you have this attitude of cognitive attitude without cognition. This you don't need to combine it with cognition. You have this attitude, and all these emotions are reorganized, a different kind of emotion. Not all emotions can be reorganized in the case of perception of work of art. You cannot be jealous. You can feel grief, for example, absolutely. You can feel anxiety. You can feel content, confronted with your work of art. As empathy, of course, sympathy, of course. You cannot be jealous. You cannot be vain. Yeah? There are certain kinds of emotions which are so much related to your egocentrism that they cannot be reactivated or recreated in a contemplative position when confronted with a work of art. Many emotions can come into being in the judgment of the work of art, because all emotions are judgment. But some emotions will never occur in the relationship of work of art, because the contemplative attitude is not egocentric. But it does not mean that self is not involved. The self is absolutely involved. The self is involved in the other. The self is involved in the other. And of course, it's expected that there should be a mutual relationship between the self and the other. That the self is extremely intensely involved, but the feeling is not egocentric. That the self is not involved in order to be able to do this or that. This feeling is not oriented in practical and pragmatic life. That's why we are entirely contemplative feelings. Now, so of course, the feeling which I term the emotions of reception are erotic in character. All the relationship to a work of art is a kind of erotic feeling. I don't want you to miss this point. Because this love for the work of art is not really spiritual love, it is sensual love. The love truly is sensual, because there's a sensual denial you get from the encounter with the work of art. That is, eroticism is always included. Without, however, egocentrism. Yeah? There is no relationship of possession there. That is, you don't want to possess the work of art. And this is why I'm saying, Kant is absolutely right when he speaks about ego of interest. Because when he mentions interest, it's basically the ego-centered character of everyday emotions. And because of ego-centered character, everyday emotions are suspended by the reception of work of art. You can say, together with Kant, that these emotions are ego interest. That is, the interest, every interest is suspended in the reception of the work of art. Now I come to the problem of how these free-floating, simple feelings are reorganized, because I promise you that I have to tell some about something which distinguishes around the reception of artwork, emotional reception of artwork, in case of different kinds of art. So I start with literature. Literature is, of course, in literature, the medium of literature is language. And since the medium of literature is language, it might be presupposed that the cognitive aspect and the aspect of situation that is there, that is the judgment of what's going on, and the judgment of the situation will be a very important part in the reception of works of literature. You can see that when you, for example, listen to a poetry in a foreign language, a language you do not understand. Obviously, you can enjoy a poetry when in the language you do not understand, you enjoy this music. That's wonderful music of this language. But that's a totally different perception than you actually need a poem in the language you understand. Because what is said in the poem, which is not the content, it's not the text, it's the situation and the cognitive impact of what hits you when you hear a poem, which contains basically the verbalization of emotions, which are not difficult to verbalize. That's because in the case of the contents of literature in general, there's a very important thing that literature, and especially poetry, is able to verbalize feelings which cannot be verbalized in everyday language. You cannot see in everyday language. Only poetry finds a language, develops a language, which says something which everyday language cannot describe and cannot express. That's why you can say that if you listen to poetry, certain things come up from the unconscious thinking. Because the unconscious is not only desire, and like Freud needed, our unconscious is thinking, there is unconscious thinking, and many things that we call imagination is basically a product of the unconscious thinking. That is, the poetry itself mobilizes unconscious thinking. Unconscious thinking appears on the level of consciousness, is brought on the level of consciousness, which gives us that indescribable joy, that joy to recognize something in a poetry which we felt unconsciously, we could never be conscious, we could never believe that it can be said. This great surprise is also a feeling you feel in this state of emotional readiness for the words of art. Now, in the case of drama, in the case of a novel, you have a story. And in the case of the story, the emotional answer of the recipient is also modified. Because the love for the work of art is double. You are, of course, involved in the work of art because you love the work, as well as a poet. But in case of a narrative genre, and drama is in this respect a narrative genre, the love is double. You love one of the heroes of the drama. You love one of the heroes of the novel. If there is a narrative, there is also identification, at least partial identification, with certain characters, with certain persons, and a kind of rejection. That is, you have an attitude of acceptance and rejection. In a story, you have putting anxiety for the person with whom you identify yourself. You feel anxiety for his or her fate, wishing for her well. You're anxious that the story should develop in the way you want it to develop. You have hopes, you have fears for the person, and this gives the tension in reading a novel or writing a tragedy or a comedy, the tension is not just the tension of the real story, it's not just a real story, that tension, like in a case of a riddle. It is a tension of identification and distance, and the identification distance, which is, however, not ego related. That's important, it's not ego related. Because the hero, you identify with them, some of the heroes. First of all, the heroes do not need to be like you. They can be entirely different from you. A woman can identify herself with a man. A man can identify herself with a woman. When you read Jane Austen, Emma, or when you read Pride and Prejudice, then you, even if you are a man, you normally identify with young girls. And if I read Raskolnikov, then if Raskolnikov is not very attractive, I can identify myself also with Raskolnikov, maybe more than with Sonya, but perhaps I identify myself with Sonya. Or I can identify myself with different characters, not only with one character. I can reject different characters, and not only one character. And you have also a kind of moral, not just sentimental identification, which gives a different answer. That is the reception, that's why the reception, the emotional reception is different in the case of a novel and a tragedy than in the case of a poem. Because in the case of the poem, this identity with the hero does not occur. And that's a different kind of tension. That is, in the case of the poem, it is far more to do with the
our unconscious imagination can become unconscious, and the expression that become unconscious. And this is true also about the tragedy, and because in the tragedy you have quality, you should see it's full of quality. And also the case in the novel, but sometimes the unconscious wishes are formulated. But it is not you. Still, it is not you. It's still another. It's still another. It has no consequences on your life. It, Julian Sorrell is executed. You will be very sad if you identify yourself with Julian Sorrell. But it has no. What does it do with your life? Nothing. It has no consequences on your life. So it can discriminate, can open equal center. Because you don't do anything with your life. This identification with the ego. And if people, if the two lovers in the novel are going to live happily ever after, then you are very happy when you close the book, but your personal life can become sad and continue being sad in spite of your, in spite of this couple living happily ever after in the novel. Now, in this case, you can have a moral evaluation, but the moral evaluation goes only through emotional evaluation. If there is a mere moral evaluation, it's merely cognitive in character, and you cannot speak about an emotional answer to the work of art. Normally, writers do not even aim at a moral deception. They do not aim at perhaps any kind of cognitive deception. But some writers aim at a moral deception or a political deception, even in poetry, and also in dramas and in novels, they aim at this kind of reception. If there is a strong purpose of the writers to have this reception, maybe there will be a negative emotional reception to this purpose, not necessarily positive, maybe even a negative reception, because the recipient wants to remain free. And in this attitude of receiving the work of art, we need the free play of cognition and imagination as fundamentally. We need this free play. And if we are, if someone wishes, if someone wants us to do this and see that and feel this and feel that, we are rather disappointed because the freedom of the emotional view of the recipient is not there. Let me now briefly return to the. Yeah, I wanted to say something sentimentalism. We often speak about sentimentalism, and mainly in the reception of novels and the reception of poets. Sentimentalism is basically the opposite of a really cognitive reception. There is really cognitive reception, but the naive recipient, we are all naive recipients if we are not. Official critics of a work of art or composers or whatever, a naive recipient basically very rarely will really cognitively receive a work of art. But it is another aspect when you merely emotionally receive a work of art. And in the case of novels and dramas, when the cognitive aspect of the reception is very low, then we speak about sentimentalism. That is a person who is crying and never, when the feelings do not make judgment and do not judge the situation and cognition is less implanted in the emotion, then normally then we speak about a sentimental recipient. And you need to get always the handkerchief when you read something. Because there is also so much touch emotionally, you cannot keep a distance. This mere sentimental reception is censored very often as the mere cerebral reception, which is not reception at all. Because the mere sentimental reception is reception, but the mere cerebral reception is not really reception. Because you need an emotional reorganization of the simple feelings into emotions in order to speak about reception. At all. Now, a total problem of fine arts, painting, sculpture, a little bit different is the case with architecture, but I also speak about architecture. Yeah, I speak only very briefly and want to mention only the new phenomena, the different phenomena which happens when you receive emotionally
the work of art which Sewell has, yeah? That the meaning of the work of art is not language, because till now we spoke about the meaning, which is language. Whether you hear it spoken on the theater, whether you read it, doesn't make any difference. Language is the medium, but no, not language is the medium. And then there are the media, and for example, in the painting, what is the media? And you can say the media is, you can say the color and the form. The color and the form, not the matter and the form, because color is not matter, it's not material. But maybe the color and the form, in the case of the sculpture, it is the form, and in the case of architecture, it's even more complicated. So I don't want to go into what is the encounter. But the problem with the encounter is the same. You others are the same. The difference in, for example, in the novel, in the tragedy, and in the conception of a painting, for example, is immediately the temporal difference. The temporal difference that you read a novel or here or in the theater, it takes time. And it takes time, you start and you continue and of course it's limited in time. You cannot be involved in love in the same work of art throughout your whole life, not in throughout one whole day. Because you can do practical things in between, but you can continue. You can return to it and always return to it to the continuation. That is a temporal thing. That the narrative genres are temporal and it is temporal. It starts and it continues and it ends. Everything in time. Now, a painting or sculpture is turned to be spatial, not temporal. That is, you look at it and immediately you are ready for the reception. With one look, with one gaze, you are already there. If one gaze, you encounter the work with one gaze. That's why you say normally that it's spatial. Lessing made a point against it, the German philosopher and Weidenhut and Weidenhut, and it is relatively so because there is time temporality in the reception of a statue as well. You go through it. And that is only, it is fictitious that it's not temporal because it's temporal and that the reception of narrative genre is also spatial in fact. I don't go into the lesson here, thing, but we can remain on the primitive level. We have the primitive level, we say it is spatial, we look at something in space, we are all us now, there is no temporality involved, all us, and we look at the same, we abandon ourselves to a painting, and the painting abandons itself to us. Look, for example, there were a young girl reads a letter. I've seen this is a very famous painting, everyone knows it. There were a young girl reads a letter. You say it's beautiful. By the way, beautiful, your concept of beautiful plays a far greater role in painting, or in fine arts in general, than in literature. Then in literature, then strategy. You say, okay, literature serves as a strategy, is beautiful. So it may be perfect, it may be wonderful, but it's beautiful or right, so what does it mean that conjures is a beautiful novel? That is, I believe that you use the term beautiful metaphorically as a simile. You mean as an aesthetic judgment. But in the case of the painting, you can see that when the young girl reads a letter, it's a beautiful painting. It's a beautiful painting. It hits you as beauty itself. But there is indeed a difference between literature and painting. One difference is, we do not fall in love with the girl who reads the letter. Basically, if you look at the painting and you say the painting is beautiful, then you perhaps do not have any relationship to the girl who reads this letter. There are, of course, certain kind of kind figures or works of art which we hear mysteriously kind works of art, like the Venus of Milo or certain kind of Madonna, the Sistine Madonna, for example, from Dresden. They become cult figures, but they become cult figures because certain authors lionize these works of art. It might be a not that cold, that beautiful, but for a whole century, at least a half a century, everyone had to feel by confronting this work of art. That is not just if I come back to it, that is a prior good and after good for us, which is cognitive and not emotional. Emotion is only why I look at it. Why I look at it, I fall in love with this painting. We don't necessarily fall in love with this girl. Maybe I do not fall in love with this girl at all. But there is a house which we can call, Lukács called it undetermined objectivity. That is, the objectivity of a painting is entirely undetermined. It's not so in normal in the drama. Basically, objectivity is determined, which means that I know what happens in Don Jones. It is not what happens in Don Jones. Everything is normal, but the thing is normal at all. And in the case of a painting, what is normal? We don't even know what is normal. We look at the painting and we make a guess. What is going on in the painting? Where is the red? Where is the yellow? Why is the red here and not there? Where is the yellow here? Well, why does it click? And what is that? Why does the girl read this letter? Is this a love letter? Is this a love letter, or is a letter in which the love says, I don't want to see you anymore? Or is it a business letter? Or what kind of girl? Is she a girl at all? Or maybe she is a married woman? Is the husband divorced? So you can make this, everything is undetermined. In a painting, even a so-called figurative painting, is everything as much undetermined as on an abstract painting. Well, and there is no difference between Miro and Vera and it is there. That is on the canvas, it's in the undetermined. You look at it, and in a way, you interpret you feeling it's beautiful. That is the love interpretation. And if other emotions occur, which do not necessarily always occur, these other kinds of emotions can be very different. And then you look at the painting for the first time, because your interpretation, your cerebral interpretation, very much participates in the emotional response, and you see that first, second, and third, and fourth, because you can get totally different emotional responses when watching the same painting by the first, second, and third time. And as I told you, it can also be disappointing. If you fell in love with the first time and second time, okay, I don't understand myself at all. Why the hell I could find love in this painting? It's not even beautiful. It's such a thing. It's a lie. I had no reason to fall in love with this painting. So this makes a very great difference between literature and fine art. There is another difference which I mentioned. The before and after can play a greater role in the reception of art. In the reception of art, what you expect from this art is plays a role in your reception. Moreover, even if the objectivity is undetermined in the art, if it is less undetermined and you have associations to this objectivity, the artwork will be poetic. Now, this word was invented, not invented, but applied by Walter Benjamin. There's an aura of a work of art. To put a long story short, I say the aura of the work of art does not stem from the relationship to the work of art to different kinds of stories or institutions, but it stems from its relatedness to a master narratives. I told you about the master narratives yesterday, you remember? So if the undetermined objectivity is can be interpreted as something which is related to a master narrative, then the painting will be original. And if the object is not undetermined, but determined by a master narrative, then it will be narrative. So if you see Christ on the cross, yeah? The Christ on the cross determines certain kind of feelings you are going to feel. Because this belongs to a master narrative, we know the context. We do not need to guess what the context is. You know exactly what, you know the story, although you do not see the story. You see a painting, all kinds of paintings, or statues, which are related to the master narratives of the European culture and or European origin. This is true also about ancient Greek gods, because you see ancient Greek gods that immediately you associated with Athens, you associated with the philosophy, you associated with Socrates, and that it makes it more rational. Now, if a person who does not know anything about the culture will look at his works of art, then I think the story of Christ, for example, Annunciation, will have no greater aura for him or her than a bone in nature. Because that's undetermined objectivity. But for us, it is not undetermined. The aura is the aura of the ground matter. If you enter into a church, the church is beautiful, the cathedral of Christ, you feel that you have to kneel down even if you are a disbeliever. Because it has the aura of the ground matter. It is there. Because God is there somehow. Even if you are an atheist, you feel that God is there. Because that's the aura of the faith. So I think the aura does not depend on the problem of autonomy or non-autonomy of work of art. And that in the present work of art, a present painting can have an aura as much as an ancient painting. If it is related to ground matter. Sometimes it is. Rouen, for example, to mention Bacon, for example, Francis Bacon, I mean. And they have that, so that strong picture, you feel you are writing that, though it is a very modern painting. So, this is also a very different thing. Well, I'm telling you, I'm sorry, we are learning late, so I only want to say one thing about fine arts. That if you are promoted with fine arts, you have a kind of emotional relationship which is different for the contemporary recipient and for a recipient who is not contemporary. The contemporary recipient feels himself person at home in this work of art. But the non-contemporary recipient feels not at home in this work of art, feels nostalgia. I think that if you now you go to a gallery and you look, for example, at a painting by Obama, peaceful scenery, religious village, cows, hands, meadows, and forest. Very peaceful scenery, very peaceful landscape. You feel a nostalgia. I would like to be there. I would like to be among them. I would like to walk in this forest. And that's not just Kobeva, Koro, or basically every kind, even an impressive painting about Jules de Pont or about horse. Yeah? You must have the feeling that, okay, I want to be there. I want to be together with them. That is, you feel this nostalgia. You do not feel this nostalgia when you see a work of art which is contemporary. But you can still make judgment, you mix the judgment, if you feel it. Yeah, but I like the public what I'm telling. The paintings, for example, works of art of the present are either only or they are uncanny. Very frequently they are uncanny for the first recipient and slowly they become cold. Unfortunately, I must go on because I know my time is terribly hard. I'm terribly out of time. So I want to very shortly, very briefly, say something about music. About the emotional response to music, about the feeling of the emotional construction of perception in the case of music. Now, if fine arts were almost undetermined objectively, at least that the objectivity was undetermined, and determined to an extent only if the subject matter of the thing or the thing itself was related to ground narratives, then in the case of music, basically, again with the exceptions of oratoria, basically every so-called pure music
is characterized by ambiguous objectivity. I speak only about pure reason. I cannot speak about need, because indeed, of course, it is also quite the objective is not entirely undetermined. In a sugar cane, we know that the lover is longing for the girl, and the girl loves someone else, so that hope determines in a way our emotional response to his work. And then opera, especially opera, it is always a gesamtkunst, and it is always several different kinds of artistic genres are combined in the presentation of an opera. And in the case of opera, you can also speak only about undetermined objectivity, after the dream, more or less the dream. But in the case of so-called pure music, a symphony or a sonata, etc., a concerto, you are confronted with the work with an utterly undetermined objectivity. The music, you are falling in love with this music, music loves you, the love relationship, the erotic relationship comes into being. Music is extremely erotic relationship is established, but objectivity doesn't exist. But to put it bluntly, it does not tell you what's all about. If we cannot grasp it, if there is no point to grasp it, as you can grasp a letter, you can grasp a girl, or a painting, or you can grasp at least this is a triangle, this is a quadrangle, and this is red, and this is right. You hear this wonderful music which carries your head, and what happens? In order to transform the feelings into emotion, the naive listener, naive listener, we start to fantasize that from the unconscious, different kind of images appear in your consciousness. You let these images of the unconscious come to consciousness. You let your fantasy freely float. And the free floating fantasy is creating emotions out of these pure feelings. These are the crutches. You need these little crutches to create emotions out of your feelings. Of course, musicologists are terribly angry at this, because they say that it's a regressive reasoning, as was Adorno said. We have to know exactly what goes on there. In which kind of dual or minor or major it is composed, and you have to follow the mathematics of this music. You should not develop any emotion whatsoever, because that's bad. You mean that you don't understand the music when you develop for emotions at all. And this is what I speak about. I speak about emotional reception. And when it is emotional reception, it's not the reception of the profession. It is our exception. And in the case of an emotional exception, we need the touches, we need certain kind of objects of around which the emotions can reorganize. So my people start to discuss the following question. Whether the second act of Beethoven's symphony, seventh symphony, is a dance, he wants to compose a dance or wants to compose a funeral march. And this cannot be designed, of course. Because for one it is a dance, for the other it's a funeral march. Independent what kind of imaginary images come out from his or her unconscious, and what really organizes these feelings into certain kind of emotions. In the case of music, we need to speak a few things about repetition. Repetition is very important in our love for all works of art. Our desire is a wish, because we do not desire to possess them, unless we are art dealers or collectors, but that's not an aesthetic perception. We do not desire to possess them, we desire to read them again, to see them again, to hear them again, to watch them again. That is desire repetition. In certain perception or emotional perception of certain works of art. For example, in novels, you very often notice that the intensity decreases, the emotional intensity decreases when you repeat the reading many times. In the case of music, the opposite is the case. That's very important in music, that the repetition
repetition increases the intensity of the emotional answer to the word of mind. You know already about your word to hear, but the moment you hear it, you feel an indescribable joy, because it is there, it is still there. This melody, you know what is going to follow, but it does not diminish your emotions, because the recognition, the hearing again, increases your emotion. That is, repetition increases the emotional answer of the recipient. Whereas it can decrease the emotional answer of the recipient in all other kinds of words of life. Now, we spoke about music, but we also are confronted all about drama, etc. That the 20th century theory and philosophy had a very ambiguous relationship to this kind of reception of work of art. I already mentioned that a normal criticizes this kind of listening to music as an aggressive listening. It's not a real music listening, it's aggressive. We don't even know what music is. We do that when we sing it. We cannot emotionalize music at all. But then this theory is Bertolt Brecht, who, as far as tragedy is concerned, developed the so-called alienation principle. That is, we should not be emotionally involved in this tragedy. We should be only cerebrally involved, cognitively involved. We have the verb is there to think about it. It's a thesis. We have to think about it. And the emotional response is a negative response. You have to think. You have to change your life, as Rilke said at the end of the poem. It addresses you. You change your life. There is a third remark about music, especially. Thomas Mann said, music is politically suspect. Music is politically suspect. And he came to this conclusion from our common experience of the 20th century that Adolf Hitler was a very great music lover. He was a great lover of Beethoven, and he was a great lover of Bach, and was also a great lover of pure music, and he was Adolf Hitler. And we also know that Joseph Stalin loved modernist poetry, and in his youth he himself wrote modernist poems. So that is the emotional reception of art, not politically suspect. The question is, and this is really the context, that the reception of work of art has nothing to do with morality. Absolutely nothing to do with morality. A person who abandons himself first at the work of art suspends all the other emotions. But by suspending the other emotion, it suspends also his morality. Morality is also suspended. The good as well as the wicked. So everything is suspended in the reception of the work of art. However, if the reception is over, you turn to your life, everyday life, political, etc., or the other emotions return. That is, you practically go through wickedness and the goodness, you will become exactly the same practical person as before. And this is why it is problematic whether what Aristotle called catharsis changes really your life. It is problematic whether the last sentence of Rilke about the accord of Orzo is really valid, whether you will change your life after you have seen something, that you have heard something. The answer is neither negative nor positive, because normally you return to your daily life, to wickedness and goodness, because emotional reception of work of art is morally different. However, you may change. It's not absolute. It depends on the after of the reception, whether you change your life or not. Because the reception has a before, the desire for it, and the after, but the make of it. You do not need to make at all anything of it. You can make the wrong thing out of it. That is such a thing as negative catharsis. You can come to the conclusion to be as wicked as Richard III and learn from Richard III how you kill your enemies. You can also come to this kind of conclusion, depending on what kind of person you are. That is, I mean, maybe music has a healing effect, but the healing effect is really psychological. It has, I mean, nothing to do with morality. No emotional reception has to do with anything with morality, as it has nothing to do with politics. even in morality and politics, a political research is aimed by the author. So this is is the last that I wanted to tell you today, because of course I have run out of time once again, and I want to keep at least 15 minutes for questions today about this subject matter. And I also promise you, that tomorrow between 5 and 2 we can discuss everything what was discussed anyway in during this week. Also, I would like to hear your demands and questions about this concrete subject matter.
Thank you very much. I totally agree with your considerations about ethical experience included in your talk. And here I have it causes more questions I can do here. But I want to basically make 3 questions. There is an aspect of relationship between emotions and reasoning in the reception of artworks, which is which begins with Aristotle and still is presented in Kant's theory of ethical judgment. And this is that there is another kind of emotion in the reception of artwork, because the distance of, in the case of Aristotle, was the distance to reality provokes that I can live suffering without suffering. I can live situations which normally cause suffering without suffering. So this distance, for instance, makes that reflection, I call it reflection in not modern terms, but reflection can mix with my emotions. So it's another kind of emotion I live contemplating a tragedy, a situation given in a tragedy, or living a situation of that kind really. So it's another thing, is in Kant's theory of ethical judgment, the basic of ethical experience is the sentiment of pleasure or pain. What makes ethical judgment? What makes ethical judgment is the reflection of the sentiments. What comes calls the reflection of the sentiments. So we have on the one hand emotion, and the other hand reflection, and the mix of the both. Emotion and reflection makes a specificity of the ethical experience. So I would, my first question would be, what kind of emotion is the result of this, of the ethical experience? If you said feeling, and I totally agree with this, feeling as being involved in something. Feeling is a kind of, as you said, a kind of judgment. But if you say feeling is a kind of judgment, it isn't necessary that reflection interferes. Feeling is judgment. Did I understand you?
Yes.
But in ethical theory, in traditional ethical theory, what makes ethical the emotion is that the fact that reflection interferes. I understand you what I want to say. And this is just the first question I have. The real feeling, the real emotion in ethical theory is a feeling that is filtered by reflection. And I would like to ask you, what do you think about that in the background of your theory of emotion exposed to it? The second question makes reference to, I really find it very interesting, and I agree totally with it. It's your observation that universal ethical theory is a thing that comes in enlightenment. You have Aristotelian ethical theory, or Noah's ethical theory, is a theory of origin. And the universal theory of art, singular, this is a modern development. In this background, I would like to ask you two things. Would you agree with me that we nowadays would need to reorient a ethical theory on the concrete reality of each art? And I would say, for instance, if you read the ethical theory of Lukács, you notice that the background of art is literature. It is a general theory of art, but you notice that the background of art is literature. If you read Adorno's ethical theory, you notice that the background art is music. But here, it's a pretension. It is a general theory of ethics. And I want to ask you if you agree that we should be a little bit more, we say it English modest, our pretension should be lower, and we perhaps instead of making general theory of art, which is much to demand, we should make a theory of fine art, a theory of music, a theory of literature, because the reality, the concrete reality of every art is too specific to to comprehend them all in one only theory. And the other thing is, what do you think that each art, and I think you, in your exposition, you have you want to say that. Would you agree that every art causes another kind of emotions, because in every art we use different organs of sense? Our experience in music is our emotional experience, our thinking. Maybe in music it's hearing. In fine arts it's visual. In literature is a totally evoked reality by language. So the modality of experience, the modality of is totally different in all of these arts. And I would just like to know if you agree with these things.
You ask many questions. Yes, I see that it is feelings and emotions that make a judgment. The lecture was about the emotional perception of works of art. Certainly, if I see emotion and presuppose that the assessment of the situation, cognition, is included in it, because in every emotion, assessment and cognition, I have to know what it is, I have to have a relationship to what happens. This is in the emotion. I don't see that it's a separate emotion and that's a separate judgment. Emotion itself makes the judgment, and the cognitive elements are always imbued in emotions. If one makes attentively a critical judgment, this imperfect judgment, when I say this rose is beautiful, is just the kind of feeling which occurs at the free play between understanding and imagination. It's the feeling. I feel that this is beautiful. That's why I say that this is beautiful. You cannot divide the two things from each other. Yes, I see that emotions, feelings themselves make your judgment. Because it is an emotional perception. Of course, you can become a professional, you can be an expert, and you can sit down and you can try at least the approach to a work of literature. Solely, cognitively, in a cerebral way, to figure out this or that from this work, to make assessment and appreciation or an interpretation of this work. There is a possibility of mid-cerebral attitude. But I spoke about the average person, of the person who is confronted with love and not in professional index to an artwork. And I think this perception is always emotion. Of course, they are related to a reality, to another reality. But when you are related to the work of art with love, you live already in this reality. You don't live anymore in your reality. That's another reality, which was called by Aristotle utopian reality. And the work of art, I don't know whether it's right or wrong, but I believe it. It's a kind of different reality. It is a utopian reality. Men suffer in a tragedy and you do not suffer. And this is why tragedy was suspect for Plato. How can one to feel joy and pleasure at the suffering of others? Because if you watch a wonderful tragedy, you empathize with the suffering hero. And at the same time, you feel joy because the poetry and how beautiful he expresses his suffering. And Plato said, that's not okay, that's not moral. And it is not moral. And it should not be moral. That's true. Now the background. Say, of course, Lukács, you are right, Lukács, when he speaks about aesthetics, writes about aesthetics, in the background there is always literature. Literature is the model for him and nothing else in the model. And myself, I'm very skeptical about it, whether there is art as such, it's universalistic concept, and you can basically to do very little with this universalistic concept. However, there are certain things which nowadays are common. And I don't see that since the term art has a tradition, it has a history. We know about this, rather than if you say art and literature, they don't say it, they use different words. That it develops something in common. Because it also depends on relationship to music, building, etc. Depends also on our approach. Whether the approach is as a work of art. And since the category work of art has been practiced, and the approach to certain things, they expect certain kind of emotions. They can expect something to happen. And it was not always the case, you never expect something to happen. When you look at the rose of the book in the garden, but you'll be hit by the beauty of the landscape, you expect something. And in this expectation, there is a lot about what we call culture. And the culture plays a part in all our expectations. Not just the expectation of emotional response to a work of art, whether it exists or not, the expectations in love. And this romantic love occurs first in the times of the Renaissance, perhaps, certainly not earlier. And first of all, in the 18th century. And the romantics did a lot, did a lot important to be not romantic. So not expect an Arab, perhaps no more expert. But certainly simple, they still expect an Arab to act according to his expectations. Now we have other expectations. But for a love, well, no marriage, we can have this expectation. If you talk to something in a kind of expectation, then you will get an answer because it's a mutual relationship. And of course, there are a lot of things it has to do with convention. It's convention. Love is convention. But I expect an experience. I expect an experience that's better than the English experience. And I expect a makeup, I expect happiness, I expect a release, I expect joy. And when I expect it, then in all probability I will receive it, perhaps I will not receive it.